I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. That's the sound of Algonquin wolves recorded by a guest naturalist, Bernie Krause. He has spent the last 40-plus years traveling all over the world with his recording equipment, capturing and preserving the sounds of thousands of species, including snapping shrimp, ants, baby vultures, and a variety of habitats, including coral reefs, many of them altered by human activity. We're going to play more of those recordings and talk with Bernie Krause about his new book. It's called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origin of Music in the World's Wild Places. He is a naturalist and a musician. In fact, he replaced Pete Seeger as a guitarist for the Weavers, and he joins us from the studios of KRCB. And Bernie Krause, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning to you as well. That's a haunting sound to hear those Algonquin wolves.
It was amazing being there. It was a couple of years ago, and I was standing outside very early one morning, and I just had set my mics up. And all of a sudden, these wolves started to howl, one pack in front of me, one pack in back of me. It was the most bone-chilling thing I've ever heard, because I've never had that kind of experience before.
And where were you?
Algonquin Park is located about 300 miles north of Toronto, and it's a beautiful place. And when I was a kid, I actually canoed from the very northern part of Algonquin Park, 300 miles all the way to James Bay.
Wow.
Which is like Hudson Bay. You know, it's a wonderful, wonderful place.
Have you always been a good listener?
Yes. I don't see very well, so my world is informed by what I see, by what I hear. And from the time I was a kid, I started with music, but gradually I kind of gravitated towards sounds of the natural world because they were so musical to me.
Are you losing your sight, or have you had vision problems throughout your life?
I don't think I'm losing my sight. I still drive, so you got to be careful when you're around
me. But it sounds like your hearing is better than your vision.
My hearing's pretty good.
You've been doing this for about 40 years, and I'm curious, 40-some years ago, what kind of equipment you were using then and what kind of equipment you use now?
Well, the equipment 40 years ago was very heavy. The recorder itself used 7-inch reels of tape that weighed
goodness.
A pound each. And the batteries in it took 12 D-cell batteries. And so the machine itself was called a Nagra. And it was so heavy that it really, literally, would give you a hernia if you weren't very careful. And you know, on top of that, you had to carry mic cables and microphones and battery supplies and tape supplies. So it ended up being around 50 pounds when you were in the field. Now I can go out for and you could only record for a day. Now I can go out for a month and record with less than 5 pounds of equipment because of the digital equipment now.
Now, you've been doing this for 40 years. How did you first get involved in not just listening to the natural world, but even beginning recording it?
I was recording electronic music at one point with my late music partner, Paul Beaver. And we had an album to do for Warner Brothers Records, which was called In a Wild Sanctuary. It was our first album for Warner Brothers, and it came out in 1970. But we started to do it in the late 60s. And because the album was the first album on the theme of ecology, and it was also the first album to use natural soundscapes as a component of orchestration. So one of us, either Paul or I, had to go into the field and record natural sounds to incorporate into the music. Hmm. And that job was left to me because Paul was terribly afraid of going outside.
Right?
I was too. We never had an animal while we were growing up. My sister and I were growing up in the Midwest. We never had an animal in the house. Fish was considered dangerous and dirty and, you know, all that stuff. So going out into the field was a new experience for me. And I went out to a national park, which is now a national park, called Muir Woods, just north of San Francisco.
Beautiful place.
It's a gorgeous place with tall redwoods and, you know, very magical. And I went out there to record, and when I turned on that recorder for the first time, the space opened up for me in a way I'd never heard before, and that changed my life. I never wanted to record inside or be inside another studio again, and here I am.
And here you are with thousands of sounds later. I'm curious, when you were in Muir Woods for the first time, what did you record, or was it just turning your recorder on and just listening to what was around you?
Well, I didn't know much about the natural world, and so when I ventured out in October of 1968, it was pretty quiet because most of the birds had fledged and migrated by that time, and there were very few vocal creatures around. There were a few ravens and a couple of crows, but not much else. And so when I turned it on, it was mostly kind of like the space, the wind through the trees. Wow. And distant traffic, but for a few birds, but not very many. And so it was really magical, and that for me was an epiphany.
Well, I do want to get to some more recordings, but I'm interested that you were, I guess, an early adopter of the Moog synthesizer, and whether that opened up your ears to hearing beyond the sort of traditional music of that time.
Well, it made you slow up a little bit and begin to think about how you were forming sound and what the components of sound were. And so when Paul and I wrote the Nonesuch Guide to Electronic Music, which, by the way, is still a standard reference, it was done in 1967.
Wow.
When we did that Guide to Electronic Music, it was really a lesson in hearing and sound for me, because I'd never really thought of it in that way before. So, the learning synthesizer and using synthesizer the way we did was really informational, and it was also transformative in a way, and one of the many steps along the route to recording and understanding natural sound.
Well, I do want to play a recording you made of ants, and maybe just as a setup for us, can you describe, I guess, how you were recording these ants, and then we'll listen to it.
Well, we were in the we were on a shoot, National Geographic shoot, in the Southwest Desert. We're doing an album for the now defunct Nature Company. The album was called Meridian, and we were following the 111 Meridian from the Mexican border all the way north to the Canadian border, because it was called the Good Red Road. It was the route that many Native American tribes took. To was seeking spiritual guidance. And so we followed that route as spring moved north 16 miles a day. And at one site in Arizona where we were camped, these red fire ants were really pretty invasive. And I dropped a couple of tiny lavalier microphones just on top of the ant hole and just happened to switch on the recorder when all of a sudden we heard all of these sounds. And when the National Geographic cameraman really focused in on what was happening, he saw the lead ant that was communicating to all the others to move the little mics out of the hole. He saw them stridulating, their back legs on their abdomen, which is really how they make the sound. So here it is.
Let's listen. Those are ants recorded by our guest, Bernie Krause. And Bernie, you write in your book that the first time you heard ants sing, and I guess that's what we're hearing, you were nearly 50 years old, and you say, "I was speechless for hours."
Well, a lot of these events that occur, the things that we record, leave me speechless, because it's so surprising to hear these animals vocalize or have some kind of sound signature. Things like anemones, for instance, and other kinds of creatures. Things as small as viruses have a sound signature, which is just amazing. So every living organism has some kind of presence that's acoustic.
And I'm assuming, looking at a broad species, if we're talking about animals, we're talking about using sound as a form of attraction or communication or protection, alarm, that there's a wide, not a, maybe as wide as humans, but a wide range of communication messages.
Sure. Well, let's back up a second.
Sure.
We're talking, you know, when I, what I talk about in the book is really how animals taught us to dance and sing, which, you know, comes from the collective animal voices that came from habitats we once lived in. We picked out and imitated the rhythms, the melodies, and the arrangements of sound as we heard them. But I'm referring mostly to the soundscape, all of the sounds that reach our ear. And the soundscape is a narrative, and it's a narrative not only of place, but it's a narrative that expresses itself over a broad spectrum of disciplines, like, for instance, not only music, but biology and resource management, medicine, religion, natural history, architecture, literature, physics, and many, many more. And the soundscape, I mean, think of it this way. The soundscape consists of three sources of sound. First is the geophony, or the non-biological natural sound that's generated in a given habitat, like a gurgling stream or waves at the seashore lakeside, and the effects of wind in the trees or grasses. And that was, and think about this, this was the first acoustic expression on Earth. The first thing that animals heard were sounds of water. And then secondly, there's the biophony, bio meaning living, and phone from the Greek meaning sound, so the sounds of living organisms. And these are the collective sounds made up of all the vocal organisms in the given habitat, whether its origins are terrestrial or marine. And finally, there's the anthrophony, anthro meaning human, and then sound, human sound. And that's all of the sounds that we make. And these are the sounds that affect the biophony and the geophony. And the biophony is the thing that I'm really concerned about and hoping to, you know, preserve. One of the neat things about my library, my archive, is that like 50% of the recordings that I've made in my archive of soundscapes, natural soundscapes, biophonies, now come from habitats that are virtually silent.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, and we have many more recordings to play as well. And again, our guest today on Radio Times is Bernie Krause. He's written a new book. It's called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. Joins us from California, where he lives. He is a musician. He is a naturalist. He has traveled all over the world for the last 40-plus years, recording some of these animals and insects and some of these landscapes as well, putting them together. And we're going to talk about what's been lost, what's been found, and what we can do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Culinary Arts Institute of Montgomery County Community College supports WHYY. Whether looking to launch a career as an executive chef or just looking to get a better handle in your home kitchen, the Culinary Arts Institute has classes to serve a full range of needs and interests. The school's certified faculty prepare students with a foundation in the classics while educating them on the latest modern trends. Details at mc3.edu/culinaryarts. The Culinary Arts Institute of Montgomery County Community College. Education at the knife's edge.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a two-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music, Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about natural sounds, the sound of the natural world, and why it matters and how they have shaped human culture. Our guest is Bernie Krause, author of a new book called The Great Animal Orchestra. And we're playing some of the recordings that he has made over the last 40 years. And I do want to play The North Sea. Let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk with Bernie Krause. Again, that's the sound of the North Sea recorded by our guest, Bernie Krause. And one can hear the music in that sound, that's for sure.
Well, certainly there's a rhythm to the waves. And that was really one of many examples that I was giving in the book of how different beaches sound around the world. This was an example from East Anglia, a place called Aldborough, where Benjamin Britten lived and worked. And the great English composer, of course. And I gave examples of other waves, too, like at Martha's Vineyard or Coney Island or Rio de Janeiro, different places around the world that have these wonderful beaches. And each place, each beach has its own signature, and that was just one of them. And you can hear what kind of beach it was because you hear the rocks.
Yep.
You hear the water moving on the and moving the rocks around, and they knock against one another.
And it's interesting to think of composers that might have grown up near various beaches and whether they were influenced either overtly or subliminally by the sound of the ocean in this case.
Debussy is a perfectly good example. Right. One of the things that I wanted to point out about this is when I got started, I was working in Kenya for the California Academy of Sciences. And one evening when I was out in the Masai Mara, I had laid back in my sleeping bag and had my earphones on. And for the first time, I heard what the natural world was trying to convey through sound. And what's absolutely remarkable about this is this biophonic expression is structured as if Darwin himself is defining the sonic timelines of evolution. The choruses in that healthy habitat went like this, and this was started like 2 o'clock in the morning. First, the insects establish their acoustic territory within the frequency spectrum. Stay with me a second here,
sure,
because this is really important.
Sure.
Then the reptiles and amphibians join the chorus. So we start with the insects, just as evolution begins. Then the reptiles and the amphibians come in, and they join the chorus, establishing their niches. And once those are set, then come the birds and finally the mammals. All of the critters together creating not only frequency bandwidth but temporal niches as well. And that's how we got our music. And, when I first started out, one of the things that was really important to the researchers around me was to record these single birds or these single mammals. We had to go out with these big parabolic dishes that were really cumbersome. And what we were doing, what I found that we were doing when I realized this event in Kenya, was that we were abstracting things out of context. We were deconstructing the natural world, fragmenting it, making it incoherent by taking these birds, because once you take them out of context, you can't put them back together again. It's like Aldo Leopold once said in 1948, he was a great naturalist that wrote Sand County Almanac. He said, if you're going to tamper with nature, you better keep all the parts. And I would add to that, we ought to keep the schematics and the building plans, too, assuming we know how to read the symbols, of course.
Indeed, hence the title of your book about the animal orchestra.
Yeah,
as opposed to the soloists.
Right. Exactly right, because the only way we're going to understand what this narrative of natural soundscapes is about is if we listen to it as a cohesive structure.
Well, let me play another recording that you did, and this is Fresh Lake. And anything you want to say to set this up for our listeners?
Well, I need to hear it. No,
okay.
I'll do it after.
That seems only fair. Let's listen to Fresh Lake, recorded by our guest, Bernie Krause. Again, that's a Fresh Lake recorded by our guest, Bernie Krause. Can you identify that?
Oh, sure. It's a freshwater lake somewhere in the Midwest. But what I want to point out here is when you compare it with the waves in East Anglia or the waves in any other area where it's salt water, which is a little bit denser, the waves come much slower in a saltwater environment. Freshwater lakes always have these rapid little waves when things are calm. And this is just an example of another geophony, in other words, geosounds of the natural world that are non-biological. It's a sound of another identification, a signature sound from a particular location.
You also write about a group of pygmies, the Babenzele?
Babenzele pygmies, yeah. They're also called the Bayaka.
The Bayaka, and how their music is because, I guess, based on how they live in the natural world, is so inspired by the environment around them.
Yeah, this is way cool. Like these guys, yeah,
well,
it's just amazing to me. Okay, what the Bayaka do, and also a group in the Amazon called the Hivaro, and another in Papua New Guinea called the, I'll think about them in a second. But anyway, what the Bayaka do is they use the sounds of the natural, of the their natural surroundings as a karaoke orchestra with which they perform. In other words, they use the sounds of the forest as a backup band. And they only break into music when certain structure, certain acoustic structure is taking place in their environment. And it could be a dawn chorus thing or an evening chorus thing. But what happens is when they hear those sounds, that triggers them into music, and that's how they create their music, and that's how we got ours, of course. But they, and they do this very complex musical thing with different melodies and different arrangements and different rhythms, all structured within one performance. It's absolutely astonishing.
Do you hear contemporary composers that maybe use the natural world the way these pygmies do?
Well, there are only a few Western composers who have got the message. One is a Canadian composer by the name of R. Murray Schafer, and he's done many, many things. He did the Patria series of 12 operas, which some of which are done around this lake near Algonquin Park, by the way. And the whole performance is conducted by the sounds of the animals in the forest. So as soon as the animals come in, that triggers the singers to sing and the musicians to play and so on, and what parts they have to play. So you have to listen very carefully if you're performing this one.
Sounds like jazz in a way.
It is almost like jazz.
Yeah.
And a second composer that really listened is an American composer, is Charles Ives. And Ives, who wrote into the early 20th century, and you know, he didn't even have his fourth symphony performed until 1963. But Ives was a good listener, and he really got what the soundscape was all about, and incorporated that into much of his music. And finally, there are other composers too who are doing that.
And that's Bernie Krause, our guest today on Radio Times, a naturalist, a musician, and author of a new book called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. And he has been to many of these wild places with his recording equipment. And we're playing some of those selections today on Radio Times and talking about some of what he has written in this book and some of the, I guess, adventures he's had recording the sounds of the natural world. I'd like to play another clip, and this is an insect larvae. And I wonder, again, should we listen to it first and then talk about it, or do you want to set it up for us?
No, I'm happy to set this one up. I had been asked to record at this freshwater vernal pond where the snow was melting in early spring. And I took what's called a hydrophone, which is an underwater microphone, with me. We record whales with it and dolphins and so on. But also, we'd never really tested to see what happens in these small freshwater ponds. And I dropped the hydrophone in the pond, and I turned on the recorder. And through my earphones, I heard all this popping and cracking. And I couldn't understand what it was. And finally, I took this scoop. And took a scoop of sand where the hydrophone or mud where the hydrophone was and poured it into a bucket and went through it really carefully, and found this insect larva, and spadefoot, toad, tadpoles, and water boatmen for the first time, and recorded this. This is the first recording of insect larva in 1984.
Wow, let's give it a listen. Now, to my untrained ears, that sounds like a summer night to me, and I'm listening to the crickets.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah,
yes.
And you know, I tell you, Marty, if you have a hydrophone, you can actually walk outside your house and by the gutter outside your house after a spring rain, drop your hydrophone in that, and that's what you'll hear all along the side of the street.
Wow. So as I was reading your book and listening to all these clips, I was thinking about silence. Does silence exist?
Yes, it does, and it does in very few places around the world, and it's a very frightening experience to find complete silence. A place that I found was in the Grand Canyon, in one of these box canyons that's very high, has very high walls, and is made of sandstone. And I had walked back from the river about a mile and tried to set up camp one afternoon, and it was so quiet that I began to throw rocks at the wall just to hear sound, because the blood, I could hear the blood rushing through my head, I could hear everything in my body, and the tinnitus that I have and the ringing in my ears got really loud, so much that it was I thought I was going to have a real serious episode. So I just packed up my gear and walked up toward the river where I could actually hear some semblance of sound, because we cannot live in a completely silent environment.
Because of the kind of sensory deprivation that comes with that?
Absolutely. I mean, you really go nuts with it in about 5 minutes. If you're in a chamber that's what's called an anechoic chamber, no sound at all, you will go nuts. But, you know, the idea is to have some reference sound around you, and the natural soundscape is the one you want to have.
I do want to play two more recordings that you made, one of an alive reef, as you have titled it, the other a dead reef. I'm assuming we're talking about coral reefs here?
Yes, we are, and these recordings were made in Fiji. And it's actually a part of the same reef. It's about a quarter of a mile long. And the first recording probably we're going to play is the live one.
Yes.
And it consists of 13 different species of fish.
Let's listen to the alive coral reef recorded at Fiji. And that flapping, are those the fish we're hearing? They're kind of flapping
their
fins?
Yes, yeah. There are 11 species, signatures represented in that recording. And it's pretty amazing. Nobody knew that fish made noise.
Yeah, they're pretty noisy. They're pretty loud. Well, let's listen to Dead Reef. Very different kind of sound. Now, dead, why?
Well, because there are no fish there. And the reef is no longer supporting the wildlife that it needs to support to make it a viable habitat. And what you're hearing in that last recording is mostly the surface wave noise and a few snapping shrimp, which still, you know, critters that still remain.
Well, in fact, you say pound for pound, the snapping shrimp is the loudest, what, critter in the world?
Well, it's the loudest critter in the animal world.
In the animal world.
Yeah. It's an inch and a half long, and it snaps its big claw. It has one very large claw, but it snaps that claw so fast that it creates a cavitation bubble. And when that bubble bursts, it puts out a signal that's 200 decibels underwater.
Wow.
It's like shooting a .357 Magnum off at your ear. And that loud.
Wow. And why is it so loud?
Well, it has a purpose. And speaking of using a tool to actually get food, you know, we thought humans were the only animals that had tools. You played those vultures at the beginning of the program.
Yes.
And these tiny baby vultures fit in the palm of your hand, but they use this resonant tube of the ficus tree, which is a fig tree in the forest. They use that tube as a resonator to make their voices sound much bigger. And the snapping shrimp does something very similar, only it doesn't. It uses its claw as an instrument, and the claw snaps that bubble, and that loud crack stuns fish that swim by if they get close enough. And when the fish is stunned, because there's a lateral line that goes from the gill to the tail in most fish, that's its actual hearing mechanism. And when the fish is stunned, the snapping shrimp kind of moves slowly over to the fish and grabs a little bite of the dorsal fin or the caudal fin and gets its meal. And that's how it does it.
We're almost up on our second break here, but I guess I'm using a very anthropological word here, but or anthropomorphic word here, sort of tricking the fish into thinking that I'm bigger than you than I actually am.
Oh, the fish doesn't know what hit him.
we should
all have that tool.
Yes, indeed. I can think of places where I'd like to have had that particular tool. Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and more sounds recorded by our guest, Bernie Krause. He's a musician. He's a naturalist. He's spent the last 4-plus decades traveling all over the world, recording some extraordinary sounds of the natural world. And he's written a new book called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. And he was, for a time, a guitarist with the Weavers, in fact, replacing Pete Seeger. He lives now in California and was an early adopter of the Moog synthesizer. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Dr. Peter Coggins, cosmetic plastic surgeon of Greenville, Delaware, supports WHYY. Combining advanced surgical techniques with fat transfer, Dr. Coggins helps to enhance an individual's natural beauty. More at drcoggins.com.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia presents a new opera as part of the Aurora series for chamber opera this June, Dark Sisters, with music by Nico Muley and text by Stephen Karam. Dark Sisters follows one woman's journey as she considers leaving a life of plural marriage and features a new production at the Intimate Perelman Theater. Five performances run June 8th through the 17th, 215-893-1018 or operaphila.org. The Opera Company of Philadelphia supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Forget other statistics. A hot economist says workers should look at the geography of jobs. Even if you don't write software, head to a place where they do. Also, rap superstar Kanye West is a pop culture lightning rod, but is he also an American Mozart? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Bernie Krause about his new book, The Great Animal Orchestra. And as I said earlier, he has traveled all over the world for the last couple of decades recording sounds of the natural world. And I do want to play another sound that he has recorded, and this is wild orcas. Let's listen. Wow, Bernie Krause, those are wild orcas. And again, I guess because you've kind of gotten us in the mood, one can hear the music in that.
Absolutely. They're so extraordinary. And in this particular case, the pod was chasing a school of salmon. And you could see them, and they were communicating with one another. There were probably 15 or 20 members of this pod. And one of the reasons that I got involved in recording orcas was because I was while I was working on my doctorate, I was trying to compare vocalizations of the animals in wild pods with those in captivity in Marine World, for instance, which was a place just south of the airport in San Francisco at one point. And I wanted to compare what they sounded like, and you could hear the excitement and the vitality in this wild pod. And when you compare them with the others in captivity, they sound so sad and lethargic. Mm. And it's just we talk about animals not having emotion and being anthropomorphic about describing animals in human terms. Well, let me tell you, a lot of animals have this are able to express emotion.
Well, speaking of emotion, and I have to say, everyone at Radio Times who listened to this had tears in their eyes listening to these beavers crying. But I wonder, before we listen, if you could set up what happened to them and why we hear what we hear.
Well, a colleague of mine has been recording at this pond for many, many years in the middle section of Minnesota. And it's a wild habitat. There are no farms around it, so there's nothing that could impede his work. And at the end of this pond, at one side of this pond, was a beaver dam that kept the water level at a certain point. And he had been recording there for a long time. And he was sitting there one spring about 3 years ago, and a couple of fish and wildlife guys came in and just dropped a stick of dynamite down the beaver dam and blew up not only the dam with the female and the offspring in it, but probably wounded the male beaver. And what happened is, and I've never heard a beaver sound like this before. I've got tail slaps, and I've got, some voices, but only short things and nothing emotional at all. But at night, that night, he recorded this beaver swimming in circles around this pond, crying. And this is the saddest sound I've ever heard.
Me as well. Let's listen. Oh, that's just so heartbreaking. I mean, it sounds like he's both injured, but it's more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, it breaks me up every time.
Oh, yeah, myself as well. We're taking calls here on Radio Times, talking with Bernie Krause about the sound of the natural world. And he has spent the last couple of decades literally traveling all over the world and recording those sounds. We are playing selections today on Radio Times and talking about his new book called The Great Animal Orchestra. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, please do give us a call. Let me get Rodney from Brookhaven to join us on Radio Times. And Rodney, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Thank you, both of you. I'm an avid and grateful listener.
Thank you, Rodney.
A week ago, a friend and I were kayaking at Marsh Creek, which is a regional state park. And we heard near the bank in the grasses in the water, crackling that reminded us of licking fire in a fireplace. You know, the
sure.
Not quite that fast, but that kind of sound. And it went on for as long as we hung around, and we could not identify it. We could not pinpoint the origin. It was all around us. Do you know anything about that?
Do you know what they might have been listening to, Bernie?
Rodney, I'd have to hear it myself. Was this a brackish or a freshwater area?
Freshwater, very fresh.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I'd have to hear it.
Yeah, in order to be able to identify. It sounds like a nice trip you took, though, Bernie. Excuse me, Rodney.
Oh, I just was saying I wish you could hear it, because it was something we had never heard before. It was quite remarkable.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, you know, Bernie Krause, I'm thinking about sort of like memory. The more you think about your past, the more you can remember things. And I think it's also true with listening. I mean, the more you listen, the more you hear. Have you found that to be true for yourself?
Absolutely. I'm listening to things in a much more complex way because, you know, we're not listeners in Western culture. We're a visual culture, and we're informed by what we see. And even though you're doing a great radio show, The idea, you know, we kind of express things as visual. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book is because I wanted to begin to bring words into the lexicon that are sound-based. And so that's why this was written.
Fair enough. We're also talking about, and I guess part of this is evolution, part of this is human activity, either endangered sounds or even the extinction of sounds, yes?
Yeah, you know, there are a couple of really great programs going on now, and it's in a field, new field called soundscape ecology, and that's contrasting with older expressions like acoustic ecology and landscape ecology. Soundscape ecology assumes that the natural soundscape consists of a combination of both, you know, we talked about these terms before, geophonies and biophonies, and is an ongoing, profoundly informative narrative. It's the world's first bioacoustic expression. And it provides us, among other things, instant feedback as to how we're treating the natural world. So, in other words, what I'm saying is, if I take a 10-second recording of any habitat in the world, I can tell you whether or not it's healthy. We don't have to go through a whole, you know, couple of years of EIR reports and the rest of it. I can tell you in 10 seconds whether it's working. And there are a couple of institutions now, Michigan State University and Purdue University, that are doing these kinds of programs and measuring habitat health and the impact of events such as global warming and human intervention and so on and so forth. And what's happened as a result of these soundscapes and the work that I've done is we branched out into many avenues of inquiry, exploring the ways in which acoustics can be used in all kinds of evaluation formats.
Would you say, though, that human activity or even human sounds, that it is destructive to the natural world or part of the natural world, if you know what I mean?
Well, it depends on the human sound.
Right.
If it's humans walking through a forest, probably not much. But if it's humans firing weapons or humans straight piping, you know, dirt bikes through the forest, or chainsaws or jet skis, or whatever it is that makes a lot of noise. You know, there was this guy by the name of James Watt, who was Secretary of the Interior.
Oh, I remember him well.
Remember him?
I do.
I loved him. I loved him. He gave me some great quotes. One of his best quotes is, "Noise is power. And the more noisy we are as Americans, the more powerful we appear to be to others." Mm. Isn't that great? And so we're very noisy.
Well, we are, but I hear some sarcasm in your voice.
Nah.
3,000 miles away. Well, let me play something else. And then we'll get back to our callers. Two other recordings you made. One is called Amazing Chorus. The first one is with a jet. And the second one...
Oh, this is Amazon.
Amazon Chorus. And the first one is with jet. So let's listen to that. Amazon Chorus without jet. Let's listen to that. So is that the same place, one with jet, one without jet?
Yes. What happened was we were recording at this one spot in the Amazon, mid-Amazon, and a low-flying jet just flew over. But what we found was is that the jet noise, what we were just talking about a few minutes ago, when the jet flew over, it silenced and masked many of the creatures in that particular biophony. And so they couldn't hear each other, so they couldn't vocalize so that they could express themselves, either transmit or receive signals. And as soon as the jet left, because this habitat is so densely packed with vegetation and critters, it's near the equator, it took about 5 minutes for it to, you know, come back to its normal level.
Let me get Rita from Cinnaminson to join us. And Rita, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had heard once that there's this thing called Schumann waves that's actually some kind of a vibration that all of the sounds of the natural world create. And that if, I know you talked about being deprived of sound, you would go crazy. But I remember reading something about them having to pipe these in to even like astronauts in space, and it's something that all animals need for balance and for their vitality. Have you heard about the Schumann waves?
Rita, let's find out. Bernie Krause, go ahead.
New to me.
Learn something every day, right?
One I haven't heard of, but I'm going to check it out.
This is maybe an unfair question. I mean, is there a place in the world where the soundscape just speaks so profoundly and directly to you?
There are several. There are still coral reefs that are alive, so we want to not forget that sound exists in the ocean. There are places in the Amazon that are still extremely vital. And my favorite of all, of course, is Alaska.
Oh, wow.
Because Alaska has maybe 600,000-700,000 people in it, and it's a huge state. And one of the places that's extremely vital and important to preserve is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's a place, it's a refuge, if you can imagine. It's a huge spot. It's probably the size of Massachusetts, and it's got no roads. It's got so you can't get in there in any way but either ski in or hike in or fly in. Those are the only ways you can get. There are no, you can't buy anything on the refuge because there are no stores there, which is we're grateful for. And the other thing is that you can't, there are no rangers telling you about the life cycle of caribou, for instance, you know, and informing you about that. You have to find all this stuff out for yourself, and you have to thrive by yourself. It's a marvelous place, and it's American. Get out there.
But not too many of you. Let me see if I can squeeze one caller. This is Jamie from Philadelphia. Jamie, we have about a minute. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I have so much to say.
I know you do.
First of all, it's Bob Moog's birthday, so I just wanted to give a shout out. You mentioned him before.
Yes.
But I've recorded frog ponds and played music along with them, realizing that they were making melodies among each other, and I just sort of played along with them to pull out the melodies. a lot of my recordings end up having cars in the background. But I just wanted to say, I mean, this all of this is screaming some kind of ecological or like in a conservationist way. I mean, how much? I mean, you must have noticed the decline of all these sounds, because I can't find frog ponds like I used to when I was a kid. And you know, I mean, I live in Philadelphia, so there's not a lot of wilds. But I just wanted to say how this impacts on conservation and what you do towards that.
I apologize for jumping in there. Let me give Bernie Krause the last 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. 50% of my archive, as I said earlier, is now from very silent habitats. So you make a really good point. And the other thing that, you know, one of my students once said is, it may be our last chance to hear the voice of the divine.
Mm. Well, on that note, Bernie Krause, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he is a naturalist, a musician, and an author. His book is called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. And he joined us from the studios in California. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Bryant, our intern. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, with assistance from Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscoen. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and check us out. Thanks for joining us.